Good afternoon, everyone. Right now, we'll have the talk Large-Scale Data Processing Pipelines at Trivago, a use case by Clemens Valiente from Trivago. At the end, we'll have time for questions. Please just wait until I hand over the mic so everything gets properly recorded. Thank you.
Mark, yeah, thanks a lot for the introduction, and also thanks for the organization for accepting my proposal and for all of you for attending this talk. I think I'm going to wait half a minute until everyone has settled down. All right, I will be talking about the pipeline that we use at Trivago to process data. I will use a specific use case as an example, but also show a bit the big picture. First, the obligatory introduction. So I'm Clemens Valiente. I'm part of the data engineering department at Trivago in our headquarters in Düsseldorf. I've been working there for 5 years. Before that, I studied mathematics at the University of Erlangen in my hometown. And the first years at Trivago, I worked as an analyst in the business intelligence department before gradually shifting to the data engineering department. So my talk will have a bit of a BI influence in there. So as I said, I will focus on a particular use case. We have and explain this one a bit in detail, including how we got there, where things are now, and the ideas of the future. Here you see a screenshot of our website. It's relatively small. I don't think you can really read it. So people can use Trivago to search for a destination they want to travel to, specify the dates or the time during which they want to travel, and we will go and contact the various booking websites for the hotel prices that they have and display that to the visitor. We really have a lot of hotels and booking websites connected to us, so this gives us really a lot of information about hotel prices, about how they develop, what their trends are, and we don't just want to use this information to show it to our visitors. We want to store this information and use this knowledge within our content marketing and communications department to write stories and articles. These kind of stories include, for example, how expensive is the Oktoberfest this year compared to last year, or how much more expensive did hotels get during the Olympics in Rio, or when is the best moment or best time of the year to travel to Dubai, and things like that. And these kind of stories, they're either published on our own traveler blog or provided as press releases to journalists and then published on blogs, magazines, newspapers, and so on. So what I'm talking about, the use case, is basically how do I turn the numbers, the prices that we're showing to the visitor, into these kind of stories that we're providing to journalists and all the data processing that is going on in between. And I'm starting out how not to do it, basically with our old pipeline that we had in place from around 2010 to 2015. And it basically starts off very simple. A user is visiting our website, searching for hotels. The front end of our website is written in PHP, HTML, JavaScript, and all the other stuff you will find on websites nowadays. And after a user triggers a search request, this request is sent to our Java backend and then forwarded to the various booking websites that have offer rooms for this hotel in question. And important to note for later on is that we actually only trigger these price requests that we're sending to the booking websites if a user actually searched for it. So we only have prices ourselves that a user has at least searched once before. And these prices are cached up to 30 minutes before being requested again from the booking website. So if you're searching for a popular destination that a lot of people are looking for, if you're unlucky, the price that we're showing you could be up to 30 minutes old compared to the version that you find on the different booking websites. All right, so it's basically infrastructure that the user gets to see. And of course, we're not just showing this to the user. As I said, we're also storing it in our own BI system. At that time, our BI data warehouse was a MySQL server. On that, we did some crunching of the data, so namely aggregating, filtering, joining, all the usual stuff before writing it to several reporting tables. And these reporting tables then could be accessed by CMC team through a small dashboard that allows them to specify a certain time period or end destination, and then it returns the aggregated price information for that selection. So we show them, okay, how expensive were the hotels, for example, during that time period. And usually they do a comparison year over year or month over month to kind of find some kind of trend or interesting development in the hotel prices that they then later on can turn into their stories. So just some quick numbers about this pipeline. So we have around 1.3 million hotels in our inventory. Hotels is maybe a bit used a bit loosely, so it's not just hotels, but also hostels, bed and breakfast, pensions, all kind of accommodation that we have in our inventory. We are connected to around 200 booking websites, so this also includes the big ones like Expedia or Booking.com that everybody knows, but also a lot of smaller ones, or example, hotel chains that only offer hotels from one chain. And in our experience, users or travelers usually search up to half a year in advance. So these are the different dimensions that basically determine how many combinations you're going to get. So if you multiply this, you would get some kind of upper limit of the amount of combinations we had in that pipeline. And as I said, this was running for around 5 years. So we had some restrictions to allow us to even do this on our MySQL server. So at the time, we only stored single night stays. So whenever a stay is longer than one night, we didn't store it forever. Because this makes things more complicated. The longer your stay is, the cheaper your price per night tends to be, because hotels usually have special offers like book 4 nights and get a 5th one for free. So makes things a bit more complicated also from an analytical perspective if you want to analyze price development. At the time, we only stored prices from our European visitors. So back then in 2010, we basically only had a presence in European markets, and everything outside of Europe was more or less irrelevant to us. As I said earlier, the prices are cached up to 30 minutes. So we only store the actual responses from the booking websites. And we only stored one price per hotel website and arrival date per day. So basically, this was the primary key on our table. In the Java backend, did an insert ignore. So whenever we already had a value in there, we just discarded the rest. So this means basically Java was sending a lot of needless duplicates to BI that were immediately discarded. And the size of the data, when we turned this thing off in 2015, over those 5 years, we had collected a total of 56 billion prices. And at the end of it, in early 2015, it was like 100 million prices per day. And if you ever try to use a table with 50 billion rows in a MySQL server, you will know it's not a very pleasant experience. And coming back to this one, so I mean, we are here on a big data conference. Why did I show you this? I mean, why is there a MySQL server in front? This is how we used to do things. And in my experience, there's a big difference between having a big data solution and needing one. Sometimes you have one, but don't need it. In our case, we really needed one and didn't have it. So where did this thing break down? In basically all possible places. Let's start with Java. So Java was writing the prices every 5 minutes to BI, which means in the meantime it had to store these prices. As you can imagine from a BI data warehouse, it's usually very, very busy. There's people doing something on there all the time. So at the end, it took often more than 5 minutes to write the last 5 minutes of prices, which meant stuff queued up and Java had to store it until it was able to write everything. So basically our BI warehouse caused back pressure and had a really significant performance impact on a really critical component of our web service. So this was basically the most important thing that broke, but also other things it broke. So the dashboard allowed the CMC team to select the arrival date, the departure date, the search date, and the destination of the user. So that's already a lot of combinations. So even after aggregating and filtering, we had to keep a very big table for them to be able to respond to their requests. So at the end, the dashboard, it took like 30 minutes to 2 hours to produce the report that they wanted. And since it was all accessing the same table, if you try to run three or four reports at the same time, it just took three or four times as long, because the bottleneck was how fast you could read from disk. So in the end, we had to limit this dashboard to be only able to process one request at a time, and all the other people had to wait. And since this kind of analysis or request is very exploratory in nature, so people have a story idea in mind, okay, let's see how the prices in Rio developed over the Olympics, then they go there and then they request the data, and often it's not finished after the first request. Maybe the first request just doesn't confirm your story, you don't find anything interesting, so you start looking for other things, and this iterative process became very, very frustrating for the CMC team. And in the end, it was also the BI team that was very unhappy, because as I said, so I was already very busy, and then the Java guys were constantly writing things in there, and then the CMC time people came and queried large amounts of data. So in the end, really everyone was not very satisfied with the situation, and everyone was unhappy, and we thought, what can we improve there? What's the actual problem? And almost relatively quickly identified, it was this MySQL server that basically had to go, was no longer keeping up with the amount of data that we had, and a new solution had to be put in place. So we sat together and talked about, what do we actually want from the new solution? First and most important for us, that was scaling with an arbitrary amount of data, so that's future-proof. Our old solution that I just presented, it worked perfectly fine with 100,000 prices per day that we had in 2010 when we were just starting out. But once we reached 100 million, it completely broke down, and we didn't want to come up with a system that is now able to handle the 100 million records, but will fail as soon as we reach 1 billion or 10 billion. So we wanted to really something where we can not be basically know, okay, this will keep running even if we scale up by factor 100 or 1,000. So it should be reliable and resilient, so it should be fault tolerant. We don't want to have any trouble with it all the time and have to monitor it constantly. Should be relatively low maintenance, basically. It shouldn't have a performance impact on our Java backend, so Java should be able to just send the prices and forget about them. No need to store or to wait for something. And we want to really also store the data, the raw input data, as long as possible, ideally forever. So we don't want to run into a situation where we aggregate the filter, the data, and store that. We always lose information, and 5 years later, some analyst comes and says, oh, I have a great idea for an analysis, and we have to tell them, oh, sorry, it's not possible. We already deleted the data that you need for that. So really, ideally, we want to keep everything forever, but also at the same time be able to process the result of that relatively fast, so that the CMC team can really iterate fast over the tables and get the information. Also, of course, this pipeline should be open source. We already made great experience with that. We generally, part of our philosophy, we don't like black boxes where we don't really know what's happening. We really want to be able to look at what the various things or tools are doing. And that's something that we want here as well, because especially with data, so many things can go wrong, so many bugs can sneak in, that you always want to really be able to follow every step that your information is taking. And lastly, but not least, we really wanted to log everything this time, not with the restrictions that we had before. And there are a lot of things to prices, more than I thought, that you can get out of there. So we wanted to log prices for all different kinds of length of stay, for different room types, so single room, double room, even group rooms. If the breakfast is included or not, is Wi-Fi included or not? There's still some hotels who charge for Wi-Fi. If cancellation is free, so all this kind of information. Room categories, so you have a standard room, you have luxury rooms, you have suites and all that. And also domains, so where the user is sitting. Unfortunately, someone from Switzerland might still be getting a higher price for the same hotel, for the same room, than someone who is located in Latvia, for example. And there's also a lot more to the actual price of a hotel than you would imagine. So I was quite confused when I talked to one of our Java guys who explained me all this. So there's really a lot of components. You have the net and the gross price, of course. Here in Europe, we show the gross price. In the US, people for some reason seem to prefer the net price and then do the calculations in their head or somehow. And then there's also city tax, resort fees, affiliate fees, and I don't know what else. There's a couple more components that are all part of a price, and we want to store all this information because later on we also want to know where the money for this room for this night actually went to. So these were the requirements. And we sat together and designed our new pipeline, basically. The beginning of it still looks the same. We still have the front end that communicates with Java backend, sending requests for prices from a visitor and receiving replies. And the pipeline that I'm showing you now, it has been in production for over 1.5 years now. In 2014, we spent quite some time testing it thoroughly. And when we were happy with the results, we switched over to the new process in February 2015, I think. So yeah, after all the requirements that I just presented, it's probably not going to surprise you to see Kafka pop up here. One of my coworkers at Trivago wanted us to use Kafka since 2012 or so, when it had just graduated. And with this project, he finally got this opportunity. For those that don't know, Kafka, it's a message queue system. You have producers writing messages to it, to topics where they are stored, and then consumers are reading from it. It kind of sounds relatively simple as a concept, but in practice, it's a lot more complicated. It's a distributed, partitioned, replicated, so it's fault-tolerant, it scales well. It's really a great tool. We are very happy with it. More to that later. And I think it's not just pure luck that it's become very popular over the past 2 years. So what it really does for us is it decouples producer and consumer. So Java can now write things without having to worry about the impact they're having on a BI data warehouse, and the other way around. BI can consume the prices at their pace without having to worry about having a negative performance impact about Java. So why did that person suddenly shrink so small compared to the slides before? It's because I need more space. As I said, we had only the European data center, but we also wanted more prices from our other data centers. In the meantime, we've grown significantly. We now have a big presence in the US, for example, but also a lot of platforms in Asia. So we have two more data centers there, where we basically have the same infrastructure, where we have a Java backend and then a Kafka cluster in each of our data centers. There's, I think at the moment, there's like 5 machines in each cluster. And these 5 machines, they are perfectly capable of handling the load we're generating. So a Kafka cluster doesn't usually need as many machines as a Hadoop cluster. And to transfer the data, we're using MirrorMaker between the clusters. So MirrorMaker is also part of Kafka. It's a small tool that consumes from one topic in a cluster, producing to another cluster. And transferring a steady stream of data across half the world is not very trivial, but nowadays with MirrorMaker, we are basically managing to get across 100% of our messages with no loss, just sometimes a small delay in case the pipeline goes down. In Kafka also, the messages are stored for 2 weeks. So this is not the long-term storage that we had in mind before, but that's not what Kafka is for. That's also no surprise here is Hadoop or HDFS, where we are storing it. We're using a small MapReduce application named Camus, which was also developed at LinkedIn. So the name already indicates a close connection. Albert Camus was a French philosopher who was influenced by Kafka's works. And yeah, since I'm already talking about names, I'm not sure when you're naming a PubSub message queue, choosing an author that never wanted to publish his works, but instead having them destroyed after his death is really the best analogy here. But I guess when you start creating these softwares, you never probably have the, never imagine at the time that it's going to be something that a lot of companies all over the world are using. All right, so we're using Camus to write to HDFS, and then we start processing it there. So this is a once per day batch process. We're using Apache Hive for that, for the very same reason why it was invented. We have a lot of analysts by now in our BI department. They have a lot of different backgrounds. So we have physics, psychology, math, or economics major, but rarely software engineering. And you can't really expect all these people to learn how to write Java MapReduce code or Scala or Python. We already had SQL warehouse before, so everyone knew how to write SQL. So for us, the choice to use Hive to keep the knowledge that we have was relatively simple. So Hive is just taking the SQL input from our analysts, translating it to MapReduce code, and then running it on our cluster. Also coming more to that later. Apart from that, we are using pretty standard Hadoop components. So OOSI for workflows and scheduling, Yarn for the resource management, and then also Zookeeper and so on. So this is how we process data within the cluster, but then we also need to get it out again to show it to our users. For that, we are using Impala. It's SQL on Hadoop for analytics, so it's really, really great at data exploration and analysis with queries that usually take between 1 or 10 seconds, even over big data sets. So at least back then, 2 years ago, Hive was still very slow with MapReduce, so it usually you never got a reply below 1 or 2 minutes, and it was basically not usable for BI or ad hoc queries or for dashboards. But Impala really filled that gap for us. And on the other hand, Impala is not really that good at batch processing and writing large data sets back to disk, since you usually have one node that's the admin, and that one can become the bottleneck. But for small result sets, so if you're filtering and aggregating over a large input, but the output is relatively small, it's just a table or a chart or something, it's really great for that. And that's what we are using to get the information out. And now the final step is to display it. And for that, we're using R. So we have quite a few data scientists in our BI department that are very proficient in R. And they came up with this package that they knew of that they were liking quite a lot. It's called Shiny. It basically provides a web interface or web server for apps written in R. You can create interactive dashboards. And another package we needed, of course, was something called dplyr Impala, which is a connector for dplyr to fetch data from Impala. So in R, you just specified a query, sending it to Impala, you get the result, and then you just render it as a table or something. I myself, I'm not very good at R, but even I was able to create Shiny apps within 20 or 30 minutes by just copying some other person's work and putting in my own filters and queries. So it worked really well. And then later on, CMC just uses these dashboards that we created in R to query the data, to filter, and to get the result that they wanted. So we've been running this for 1.5 years, so we can already provide some results. So we are really happy with the system. It's very reliable, and we barely had any downtime or service interruptions. So the biggest issue usually is getting the data from Asia, from Hong Kong to Europe. Sometimes there are interruptions. It's not a very reliable connection all the time, but usually it's just causing some delays, and we have to catch up. The Java team is very happy. They really have a lot less load on the system. They just send the price off. They're using the native Java producer that Kafka provides, just sending the price away, and then they're done with it. The BI team is also very happy. They now have a lot more data and a lot more resources to process it. But most importantly, also the CMC team is very happy. So they get the results much faster. So instead of waiting for 3 hours, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and they get a result, the result also has a much better quality because we have a lot more prices. So even in smaller towns and villages, we have enough information about the hotel prices there to provide them with statistically significant data. And the results are also a lot more detailed because we have a lot more information about the prices. So this means the research files is much shorter. They can iterate and iterate faster and confirm their stories much faster, creating more of them and better ones. And also for the BI team, it means we have a lot less requests and workloads from the CMC team for us, for BI, because they can do a lot more on their own. So some numbers, facts and figures. So our cluster is not as big as Criteo or Uber that you might have seen here at the conference already. Well, I think it's still decently sized. We have, I think, like 50 machines right now, around 1 petabyte of disk space that we're using. And our machines have, I think, between 24 to 32 threads and I think 128 to 256 gigabytes of RAM, depending on when we bought them. So they're not all the same. When Hadoop advertises the fact that it runs on commodity hardware, I think it's still commodity server hardware. So these are still fairly powerful machines. The price lock that we have collected so far is now consists of 2.6 trillion messages that are all stored on HDFS. And we get up to around 7 billion messages per day. And that topic alone is now on HDFS is like 160 terabytes of data that it takes. For the processing, the CAMU is running every 10 minutes with 30 tasks on Hadoop, writing the data from Kafka to HDFS. Then on HDFS, we have a Hive table created on top of the data, and the first aggregation or filtering stage on that raw data runs in like 20 to 30 minutes and spends a total of 5 days of CPU time. So this is always great visualization of how powerful the parallelization here actually works. And the Impala queries run across result tables that are 100 gigabytes in size and are usually done within a few seconds. And it's also, of course, has a big impact on the usage of our cluster. So by now, we have 35 BI analysts using Hadoop daily, writing queries in Impala and Hive, and creating UCI workflows. Around 100 Shiny apps that we have now that are serving insights to around 500 users monthly. So we only have around 1,000 employees in our company, so half of them are using Shiny at least once per month. But a lot of them, a lot more regularly, up to once per day. And we have around 5,000 Impala queries per day, reading around 5 terabytes of data. So this price lock was, of course, only a pilot project. And this one use case is just an example. We also have a lot of other uses for this prices, of course. So one important one is we can use it to monitor price parity in the hotel market. This is very important for us because we're a price comparison website. And if every booking website has the same price for every hotel, then we're no longer useful. Basically, this helps us to see if we actually still have a valid business model. And another one is anomaly and fraud detection. So for some booking websites, we actually already deliver a very significant share of traffic to them. And they might feel inclined to kind of manipulate their prices to achieve a better position on our website. So we need to monitor that to make sure that nobody gets an unfair advantage over the others. We can use this for price heats for online marketing. So probably all seen this display advertisement or Google search engine results where it says buy this product or book this hotel starting at 70 euros or so on. And we can use our log to feed our advertisement with prices that the user will then later on actually find on our website. I mean, if I usually click on advertisements, then I never find the price on the final website that I was offered in the advertisement. We are trying to make sure that this the user experience here matches between what they see on the advertisement and what they get from us. Another thing we're doing is we can use this information to display price development and delivering price alerts to the website visitor. So they can, when they look at a particular hotel, they can see what the hotel price was like over the past weeks, what it's gonna be over the next weeks. I can find cheap or more expensive periods. They can also sign up for an alert, send me an email as soon as this hotel drops below 110 euros or something like that. But yeah, it was just a pilot project, and the other rest of the business logic basically quickly followed after it proved to be successful. So other data sources that now use Kafka and Hadoop, for example, include the click log information, so the user interactions on our website, and in our mobile application. So this is used for marketing performance analysis, for example. So how many visitors came in through a campaign, how much money did they generate for us. Product tests, so A/B testing new features on our website. Also, ultimately, the invoices that we are sending to our the booking websites that work with us are generated using the data that we get from Kafka and Hadoop. So overall, our entire BI business logic now runs on and through the Kafka Hadoop pipeline, and almost all the departments rely on data insights and metrics delivered by Hadoop. And most of the company basically couldn't do their jobs without Hadoop data. Marketing departments couldn't optimize their campaigns. The product department could not find out if their new feature tested positively or negatively, and so on. So almost everyone relies on this information. So that's what things are like now. But I mean, we learned a lot over the past years. We did quite a few things wrong. And so we still have a lot of plans and ideas for the future that we want to do. And I'm going to also introduce a couple of those. So for the price lock at the beginning, when we set it up, we didn't really care about the format of the message. So we just sent it as CSV. It was a bad mistake, as it turned out. Later on, we agreed that we will have a unified message format. And we chose protobuf in that case, because we already had some experience with that before. So nowadays, everything that is going into Kafka is in protobuf. Afro is basically very similar, and actually nowadays I kind of regret going for protobuf. If you have the choice, use Afro instead. I mean, they're both doing similar things, but Afro is just a lot better integrated into the whole Hadoop ecosystem. Almost all the components you see here, they already know how to speak in Afro, but they don't know how to speak protobuf, so you always have to write a survey to teach them. It's not terribly complicated, but it's always that extra step you have to do. But yeah, message I'm trying to deliver is really settle on one, preferably Afro if you can, and just use it throughout. And then you will have a lot less issues. Next step, when we write our data to HDFS from Kafka, then our nice real-time message delivery system basically turns into a boring old-fashioned batch process. And we want to have less of that. We want to do more stream processing. For that, we decided to use Kafka Streams. It's officially part of Kafka for around 6 months now. It's a relatively small library. It doesn't really have the big overhead that other stream processing frameworks like Spark, for example, have. And it integrates really well with using Kafka's features. So it already has elastic scaling using Kafka's consumer group, so you can easily turn off or add another task to process your pipeline. It has event-level acknowledgement, so you don't have snapshots like in Spark that take a snapshot of the current state of your stream process, but instead the local state of your stream processing apps is replicated back to Kafka and committed there. So basically for every event you get a new commit and you don't lose any data in between. And yeah, so we want to do as much processing already in the Kafka stage and as little processing later on in Hive on HDFS. Another thing is that Camu is no longer maintained, and its official successor is Goblin. It's also by LinkedIn. It's a general ingestion framework for Apache Hadoop that basically can read from different data sources like Kafka, but also from REST APIs, from FTPs, from relational databases. It has a quality checker and a transformation stage, so you can convert your messages into a different format before writing it to HDFS. As an alternative to that, on the Kafka side, there's Kafka Connect, which basically provides a lot of syncs for Kafka, so you can write from Kafka to a lot of different storage systems, including HDFS. So it depends on from which side you're coming. Goblin is something that writes into HDFS from different sources. Kafka Connect is something that writes to a lot of different storages from Kafka. So they're both doing very similar things in our case here for this. I think at the moment we are probably going for Goblin because it already has a quality checker stage included. So you can, in that, you can already do something like message deduplication in case it's necessary, or doing some other kind of quality checks for your information. Also, we want to get rid of, not of Hadoop, but of MapReduce. So if we used MapReduce or Pig or Crunch a few years ago, and we wanted to use Spark now, then we would have to basically rewrite our entire business logic, and we want to avoid that. And with Hive, that's the real big feature for us. Hive is just an abstraction layer between what we are telling it to do in SQL and the code that is later getting executed. And we can simply tell Hive to execute everything in Spark with a simple configuration setting by changing the execution engine. I think Pig is now, there's that talk right now somewhere else here at this point that presents the same concept for Pig, where you can translate your Pig code not to MapReduce but to Spark. So basically the same concept. The idea generally is you don't want to rewrite your business logic every time you want to transition to a new system for processing it. And there's also other execution engines like tests that you might have already heard about. And I don't know what's next. So there are some efforts to integrate some kind of SQL, maybe it's Calcite or Hive, with Kafka streams. So you can write your Kafka stream apps with in Apache Hive, and then it translates basically to a Streams app instead. That's also something that we are very interested in, because then we basically already have everything we need to do stream processing. We just need to move it from the code from Hadoop to Kafka. There were also some development on the right side with Impala. So there's Kudu now that is out. It's also a different file system than HDFS. It has better performance for random workloads. Or Apache Kylin with HBase. So basically Apache Kylin pre-computes or pre-aggregates your OLAP cubes in Hive and then writes the result of that to HBase. And then your apps, your dashboards only need to read this very small result set from HBase. The disadvantage of that, of course, is that you're still tied to that batch process where you compute your new cubes once per day and write them to HBase, and you don't have the data available immediately. If you really want to expose the result from the stream processes immediately to the dashboards, then you need something a bit more ambitious. So, for example, using Druid. So we would basically stream all the output from our stream processing apps into Druid and query the data there. So Druid is really good at streaming data ingestion. It has super fast OLAP queries and aggregations. And this is something that I'm also very excited about, trying this out, to be able to really provide users with a super fast interface and getting the information to them as fast as possible. For example, use case for this is A/B testing. Usually at the moment, if a person turns on an A/B test, a new feature on our website, we would have to wait until the next day until we get to see the result. And even if the result is just 1% negative or 2% negative, that's already quite a lot of money that is getting lost there. And sometimes we could already tell after 2 or 3 hours if this test is performing significantly negative or not, and act about it. So there's also a lot of business potential there. It's all about basically being able to iterate faster and faster again. And another very exciting possibility is querying the local state of our stream apps directly. So the Kafka Streams app basically has its own local state where it stores all the information it needs to do processing. Usually this is a RocksDB. And with the latest version of Kafka, I think 0.10.1, this local database is now exposed also to third parties. So instead of having to write the result from your app back to Kafka and then to our database and then reading from the database, you can just access this local state directly and query that one. Of course, since it's a RocksDB, you can't probably do too many fancy things there. But for some use cases, it's very interesting. You can basically bundle your application with the Kafka Streams application, and you don't need to worry about needing a database somewhere in between. You just query the Kafka Streams app directly, and you get the result immediately. And other stream processors are trying to do this as well. So I think Apache Flink has plans to expose their local state, because it's a really powerful feature, maybe not for BI purposes, but for microservices, for example, if you want to treat a streaming app as a microservice, or if you just have a small app that processes the stream for your application, it can be very powerful. All right, finally, a few challenges and learnings we had over the past years that I wanted to share. One big hurdle at the very beginning for us was finding our log files. You have Yarn, you have OOSI, you have application masters, you have containers where your mappers and reducers are running. They're basically all over the place on the name node, in the data nodes, and it took quite a lot of experience to really find out where you need to log to find out what's going wrong. And even if you find the log where you get your error message, then it's also sometimes quite difficult to actually understand what this means. And Hive, Apache Hadoop, HDFS, they all offer really a lot of settings to change their behavior, and so some of these settings really have a very big effect, and it also takes quite a while to really understand what these settings do, why they do it, and what kind of effect it has, and how you can use that to solve your problems. So this was a big step forward for us when we finally had some grasp of all the configuration settings that we can do to influence the behavior of Hive. Regarding Kafka, it was a beginning a big challenge to, especially if you're just reading messages from one topic, it's very hard to tell if you're already finished reading all the messages from a particular time frame. So especially if you're distributed across the world, you have messages from Asia and from USA arriving, you don't know when you will be actually finished reading all the data from the last 10 minutes, for example. And for that, we implemented an audit log, so all our producers are also writing to a separate topic where they just tell for a specific time frame how many messages did they generate for the other topic. So later on, we just read this audit log and the topic that we're interested in, and we compare and can find out if we actually read all the messages that we are supposed to read. And there's also some kind of anomaly detection, because if your application goes down completely or a server goes down, then you don't get any messages in your audit log either. So if you just look at the counts, they will still be equal, but you will, if you look closer, you will notice that one server stopped sending messages altogether. Also in Hive, we had to kind of forget our experience with a relational database, where you usually store everything in star schema in different tables and join it. In Hive, we basically created very wide big master tables with a lot of columns, denormalized nested data types, so basically arrays within arrays that are representing the hierarchical structure of the data, and stored in Parquet or Parquet, which is very useful if you have these wide tables, because Parquet is columnar, which means you only need to read the data from the columns you're interested in. And if you have tables with 100 different columns and you're only interested in two or three of them, then you really can save a lot of I/O there. For the users of Hadoop, so for us, a big focus was always on the end users, on the BI analysts using Hadoop. It was important to offer easy access to it for them. They're not going to use a command line interface to connect to HDFS to copy a file or something like that. Fortunately, by now, most visualization tools and SQL Explorer kind of tools, SQL tools, work with the Impala and Hive JDBC, so they can just continue using what they used before and connect basically to to what looks like a different database to them. It's also important to educate users on how to write good code, have strict guidelines and a code review in place, so no system in the world scales with our ability to write bad code. And at the beginning, we just let them use it, but after a while, we noticed that it's kind of a bad idea, and you really, even if you have a small cluster or a big cluster, doesn't matter. I can always write a query that basically slows down and kills the entire cluster if you just let me do it. We had also to come up with a good deployment pipeline for all that. So nowadays we have a Jenkins instance that basically deploys a Git repository containing our OSI definitions and Hive scripts to HDFS. That works really well for us, because the OSI scheduler just picks up the current definition of their OSI actions and their Hive scripts from HDFS, so we don't need to compile anything, we just copy it to HDFS, and the next time the action runs, it automatically picks up the new version of the script. Lastly, what's still challenging, so HUI, the web interface that we're using for Hadoop, it's not working very well. There's always some kind of bugs going on or new bugs introduced. We're not very happy with it, but we also haven't found anything much better than that. OSI, or in general workflow manager, so writing OSI definitions in XML is also not very enjoyable, especially for BI analysts. It's one of the points where we always have some sort of contention between what should data engineering be doing for BI and what is BI supposed to do themselves. So this is making things a bit difficult. Monitoring Impala is also kind of difficult, because it's distributed, you have data running it on all data nodes, and you always have to find the one data node where your query was submitted to find out what Impala did with that query. And there are also still some hard to find bugs in Hive and Impala. For example, we had one in Hive where it simply was returning a slightly incorrect result. That took a very long time to find for us. And also there's still a memory leak with Impala and HUI, where HUI fails to close queries properly if the query is finished with an exception. So after a while, your Impala daemons will crash and restart, and this is also causing a lot of trouble for us. Yeah, so these are the challenges and learnings, and it's also the end of my presentation. I'm more than happy to go also a bit more into detail in some of the components if you have any questions. I think the microphone is ready.
Hello. You've been talking a lot about how you get data from Kafka. What about putting data inside? I mean, do you use a REST interface or something like that?
No, for the Java backend that I introduced, we're using the native Java producer. For PHP, we are using Golem, which is written by us. It's a multiplexer. It's also open source. You can look it up, Trivago Golem. It's basically a Go implementation of a Kafka producer, and PHP, and it listens to a socket, and PHP just writes the messages to that socket.
But I mean, how do you get the data? For example, from those portals, from Booking, do you got a JavaScript component inside that to get the click streaming or something like that?
So basically, we're using their API to connect to them, and that's what the Java backend is basically responsible for, to connect to those booking websites and request the prices. I'm not too familiar with the details in there. But yeah, it's basically the main purpose of our Java backend to do these price requests and to cache them and deliver them to PHP.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're going to be rolling out a lot of changes to your cluster, replacing Camus with Goblin or something else. What's your plan on rolling this out? Do you have a separate cluster where you test everything first?
Yeah, I mean, just saying everyone has a development system, not everyone has a separate production system. For us, we finally have a separate, we have this separator, and we're going to start basically consuming some topics in Goblin. and then just running them for a while in parallel to see if the counts match, and then gradually switching over. I mean, it's just an application that runs every 30 minutes, and it's something that you don't need to give a lot of thought about the switching over. You just turn off the one and start the other one, and a small interruption is not a big deal.
Hi, thanks for the great talk. How do you deal with any Kafka cluster failures or just regular downtimes, especially from the data producer's perspective?
For our PHP side, for Golem, basically it writes to local disk if it cannot reach the Kafka cluster. And so spooling, basically, and once it can reach Swim again, it basically consumes from the disk and produces back to Kafka. I mean, fortunately, since we're still in a lot in the batch process, interruptions during the day are not affecting us yet so significantly, because everything is fine as long as the data is there by midnight. It happened a couple of times that data was not there by midnight, which meant we had to wait until Camus caught up and wrote all the messages back to HDFS, and then basically we had to restart our batch process, which is a pain to do, but we designed it in a way that we are easily able to just restart it and just have it produced again.
Okay, thanks.
So you said you are planning to move to stream processing with Spark. That's what you said before. This could be an evolution of your infrastructure. Why in 2015, when you moved to Hadoop, Hive, or you considered stream processing in 2015 when you changed the infrastructure?
Yeah, we at that point we were not really able to do that yet, and we were still a small team of three people, and we were just barely able to keep up with migrating everything from the SQL warehouse that was basically 5 minutes before dying into the new system. And with Hive, it was not that difficult because you can more or less translate it very easily, but with stream processing, you really have to put a lot more thought into it. Nowadays, we are using Hadoop, we are safe. We have the time now to really do all these considerations that we need to do before coming up with a concept for stream processing. That's why we are tackling it now.
Hi. Have you found any problem in Kafka about duplication? That at some time you mentioned it about doing something for the duplication in the next year. And in case, if you have already thought about something for solving this problem?
I think the cases where we had problems, it was not Kafka's fault, but it was our fault in the Golem implementation in our Go producer that was causing these duplicates. It took us a while to figure these out. Nowadays it works fine. I cannot guarantee that we don't have any duplicates. For the topics, for the kind of information that we're reading, a very small amount of duplication is not really impacting us negatively. So if we get a price twice in there, it really doesn't do any damage. So in other use cases, it might be a lot more important, but for us, a duplication here and there every now and then wouldn't hurt us, so we haven't really noticed anything big there.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, thank you for the talk. It was really good. My question to you is, you're using Java to, you know, bring in all of the real-time price data. Yeah. Are you doing anything with the web logs? Having worked with the price comparison website before, the main data that you guys generate is the web logs.
Yeah, that's the user interactions that I mentioned before. So these are also going through Kafka and Hadoop nowadays. So of course, I would actually say for us, for the business, it's even more important for us as the prices. So of course, they're also going through the same pipeline nowadays. It's just that we use the price log as kind of our pilot project to test all this.
Okay.
More. You
You mentioned that one of the first obstacles was to find the right logs in the right places.
Yeah.
So did you manage to find out how to centralize logging or storing the logs from Hadoop cluster?
We tried some things like writing the logs to HDFS and then creating a table on top of them and then querying them in Hive or things like that. But at some point we noticed we had like 50 terabytes of logs running around, and nowadays we're not keeping them long enough anymore and we're not doing anything. I think we just got used to going through Hui and through Yarn and OOSI and down to the individual tasks and finding them. So it's just a matter of experience, I think.
Thanks. Any other questions? No?
I think that's it. Thanks a lot and enjoy your lunch too.
Applause, please.